this is the legal disclaimer, where I tell you that the views, thoughts, and opinions shared on this podcast belong solely to our guests and hosts, and not necessarily Brady or Brady's affiliates. Please note, this podcast contains discussions of violence that some people may find disturbing. It's okay, we find it disturbing too. Welcome back to another episode of Red, Blue, and Brady.
I'm one of your hosts, Kelly.
And I'm your other host, JJ.
And today, we're lucky to have an old guest of the pod, journalist John Woodrow Cox, back with us.
John recently published a piece in the Washington Post called The Overlooked Orphans of Gun Violence, which found that over 40 kids a day lose a parent to gun violence in the U.S. That is just devastating. And we knew that we had to talk to him about his study, his work, and what we can all do to bring that number down.
My name is John Woodrow Cox. I'm a staff writer at the Washington Post, and I'm the author of Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. And I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And the book now in paperback?
Yes, recently, very recently.
For folks to pick up. And we do highly recommend it. You've been on this podcast before. We've talked about the book, which for our listeners, you know, stop, go back, listen to the episode, I believe 125, come back again. But in that book, you talk about some of the ways that gun violence really harms children in a physical, mental, and emotional way. But your work has kind of now taken a turn into focusing on children who've lost parents to gun violence specifically. And I'm wondering where that progression came from.
It's a great question. And the origin of this project dates all the way back to the very first kid that I wrote about in 2017, and who is one of the two central subjects of the book. His name is Tyshawn McFadder. He was in second grade when his father was killed outside of his school in Southeast DC. And, you know, I followed Tyshawn for the news story in the Post, a narrative for a couple of weeks, and then followed him for many months for the book. But early on in my reporting, I wondered how many kids did Tyshawn represent? Because I had seen the way that losing his parent had derailed his entire life. And, you know, this was a kid who was not, you know, legally considered a victim of anything, but clearly was a victim of gun violence. And I thought most of these kids are represented in kind of passing news stories where they say something like a father of three or a mother of two, and that's it. And you never learn anything more about the loss, the trauma, the suffering. What have those kids gone through when they lose a parent to a violent act of a shooting? So that set me off onto a very long process of accumulating all of this data. What we did was we looked at 20 cities, 20 of the largest cities, most violent cities in America, over a single year. And I got homicide data for every one of those cities, specifically looked at gun homicides, and then broke down manually how many children each of those victims of gun violence had.
I wondered if we could touch on, so when you say that these kids would not be considered, you know, a legal victim, I wonder, is that just because they're not, you know, quote unquote, harmed directly because they haven't been shot, they haven't been murdered?
Yeah, exactly. Because our system, you know, when we talk about victims of gun violence, it almost always comes down to physical harm, right? It's not emotional harm. It's not. So, you know, in some cases, somebody who maybe was threatened with a gun or a child, let's say they were a direct witness, sometimes they might be considered legally a victim, but generally they're not. You know, generally you have to be physically harmed with a firearm to be considered a legal victim of gun violence. And you know, much of my work has been devoted to these groups of children who are not legally considered victims. There's sort of these hidden uncounted populations of victims, and certainly children who lose parents to gun violence, I would count to be central among that group, because my reporting has revealed to me that they suffer immensely, often for years after those losses.
I'm glad you mentioned that distinction about how the law might consider victims, because I know even victims who are shot, sometimes there's a undercounting or discrediting the emotional suffering that someone can go through simply because, oh, well, they survived, so it's fine. And in your most recent reporting, you talked about an original study with the Washington Post that found that, this is a quote, across 20 cities, there were the site of nearly a quarter of the nation's gun homicides in 2020. More than 3,600 children lost their mother or father in a shooting, end quote. Could you talk a little bit about how that study came together?
Yeah, it was arduous. I mean, it was really many months of the process was just, you know, I would take the name of the victim, put it into Google with the combination of words and just trying to find any sort of publicly available information at all. And there were a few interns who helped with that process because it would have taken one person years to complete. Because, again, it's a quarter of all the gun homicides in that year. And so we used obituaries, news stories, people's Facebook pages, public memorials to victims of gun violence, all in an effort to just try to find out how many kids that they had. And what we were looking for, I won't go into all of the sort of rules that we applied, but we were looking for children who were underage. So if somebody had an adult child, we did our best to discount those. But we know that 3,600 is an undercount without question, because so many people, when they're shot to death in this country, there is virtually no record of their life. There is a 4-paragraph news brief saying, you know, the person's name, their age, where they were killed, and that's it. You know, if you couldn't find a Facebook page, a memorial, an obituary, which was true for a great many of these victims, you know, we didn't know. We just never knew. So we know that 3,600 number, as shocking as it is an undercount for sure.
And it strikes me, too, that you have to know that the number is higher, too, when you think of folks who are parents or guardians, but maybe not like legally recognized as a parent or guardian as well. Right. I'm sure there are also their step parents and aunts and uncles and things who are caring for folks. And
for sure. And we didn't count, you know, specifically, I came across lots of grandparents, lots of step parents, and we didn't count those because we were trying to sort of have the most narrow definition that we could so that, you know, sort of no one would think we were inflating these figures for any sort of, you know, political reasons.
Yeah. And so yet, even though with that really narrow definition, you still, these numbers, it's, you know, as you said, it's 15,000 children in America that are losing a parent. So that's roughly 41 kids per day then that are left without at least one parent. In your reporting, you detail though that there are children who have lost both, you know, that they've lost their whole support structure. And that's a really hard number to swallow. You know, at Brady, we talk all the time. There's, you know, you lose 100 people a day to gun violence. But sometimes I think when you say those numbers enough, it doesn't hit people as much. And so I wonder what does that mean to you, having talked to so many of these kids or interacted with so many of these kids? What does that 41 per day actually mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's where you get people to care, I think, right? Is when you humanize that figure, that 41, what does that actually look like? You know, the two kids that I focused most of the story on were a brother and sister in Baltimore who had lost their father in 2017, their mother in 2020, and both of them had suffered profound grief, trauma, really complex trauma. You know, in the case of Kaylee, the daughter who was with her mother in the moments before she was killed, she still is dealing with an overwhelming sense of guilt because she became convinced that if she had stayed with her mother rather than going inside this housing complex, that the shooter wouldn't have killed her, that the shooter would have seen a little girl there and said, well, I'm not going to pull the trigger, which probably isn't true. And that's what her brothers told her many times, is that, you know, would have just been the two of them dead rather than just her mother. But she struggled to get past that, you know, and she's had vivid nightmares and about what happened that day, and a sense that, you know, her aunt now is taking care of her. And for months, she couldn't sleep without her aunt, because not because she was afraid of her own safety, but she was afraid if she slept away from her aunt that she would lose her aunt, too. So, you know, and that was just her trauma. That was just one child's struggle afterwards. You know, we talked to families all over the country who had been in the situation, and kids had dealt with, you know, enormous amounts of fear, anger, you know, just sort of the classic traits of PTSD. And again, these are kids that are generally overlooked, even within their own communities, even at their schools. Because again, they're not physically harmed. You know, there's that moment of we're so sorry for what you've gone through, and then people move on. But these kids don't, you know, they suffer with this for the rest of their lives.
And you mentioned not just trauma, but complex trauma. And I'm wondering if you could kind of help listeners understand, what does that mean? What does complex trauma mean?
So, you know, I think it means in some cases that, you know, every child's going to deal with it differently. There was a moment in my reporting that I'll never forget in this particular case, in this particular story, that the brother, Kayvon, you know, he was 11 at the time that his mother was killed. So 2 years ago, he's 13 now. And he had told me that he was in a class at school and his mentor had asked him, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And he had refused to answer. He didn't want to answer the question. He kind of blamed it on, well, I don't want to stand up in front of people. And I didn't really believe that. And so I pressed him a little bit on why he didn't answer that question in school, because I didn't really believe it was about stage fright. I thought that there was something deeper there. And so he's laying on his grandmother's couch. And what he said to me, this is the exact quote. He said, everybody don't make it to the next 5 years. Where I want to see myself in 5 years is alive. And he's 13, right? And he wasn't saying that because of the way he would read in the Washington Post. He was saying that because that is truly how he felt. There was a sense of fatalism in his life. And, you know, he knew, he had a sense of what he was capable of. He was a kid who made really good grades in school. He was great at math. He was really smart. But, you know, when so much of your life has been defined by loss, by, you know, your dad's gone, you know, 5 years ago, your mother's gone 2 years ago, you know, what expectation could he have that he's going to absolutely make it 5 years from now? And so when we talk about complex trauma, I mean, that's sort of the way that it can come out, is a kid questioning whether he's going to be alive when he turns 18. And what ways does that affect his decisions today? We don't think about those things often. We think about grief and sadness, right? Those are kind of the ways that we typically think about the aftermath of loss. But a lot of these kids also deal with a huge amount of anger because it's unfair and they know it's unfair. And it's in some ways, they don't know how to express themselves. And what that can lead to is kids getting suspended and expelled and getting in trouble with police officers because they don't have a healthy way, a healthy avenue to express what it is that they're going through. And then people don't recognize that these are signs of trauma rather than signs of bad behavior, right? And there's this shift right now going on in the therapy world and, you know, this trauma-informed teaching. And the question has shifted from not what's wrong with you, but to what happened to you. And I think that's such an important shift in the way that we talk about, especially children who've been impacted by gun violence.
Well, and then especially to children who are living in areas where they're going to be consistently, it seems, re-traumatized by gun violence beyond the sort of standard trauma that everyone living in the U.S. gets of living with gun violence. Because as you detail in your article, he is even almost the victim of a shooting of himself just picking up food.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He's standing outside a Chinese restaurant waiting for his egg roll and somebody opened fires right next to him. He thinks he's been shot. You know, he runs home, he strips off all of his clothes and he's hyperventilating in a, you know, total panic attack. He's convinced that he's been shot and he's going to die. So, and those sorts of things make him revisit his parents' loss, right? So it is incredibly complicated for children who are living with that sort of chronic threat of gun violence.
And not to sort of switch tack, because I think it fits too, you know, when we're talking about this loss, I want to make it really clear to our listeners, something that shocked me even looking at the numbers of the study that your work and the work with the Post pulled out, is that none of these stats we've talked about have involved talking about parents who have been lost to firearm suicide. This is, as you said, this is pure homicide. And so I'm wondering if was that a distinct choice just because it's not reported on in the same way?
Yeah, it was not. It's just not gettable. It's not a thing that, you know, you can't go to a police department and say, you know, give me all your gun suicides. We sort of did what we could do. And that was, I knew I could get gun homicides, the names of gun homicide victims in these cities. And then, you know, it was something I could actually report out. But we just knew, you know, it is so hard to report on gun suicide in this country because we seldom know even who the victims are. You know, there is no news story. There's an obituary that won't address it directly. So often people, neighbors can die by gun suicide and you'll never know. But we know, of course, that a huge number of people every year, most people who die in shootings die by suicide. So, you know, that number, if in reality, is certainly over 100 kids every day who are losing a parent to some sort of form of gun violence. I have zero doubt in my mind that it's over 100 because of the kids who lost parents to gun homicide we couldn't find, and the tens of thousands of kids who lose parents to gun suicide every year.
I mean, if we lose 60 people a day to firearm suicide in the U.S., you know, just even assuming that five of those people are parents with children who are underage, that's a wild number. Yeah.
And wild number is, I'm just trying to like sit with it and take it all in, because even without including suicide, that study in the Post found that there were only 11 days, only 11 in all of 2020 when a parent had not been shot and killed, which is stunning. And so, you know, beyond the obvious pain and trauma inflicted on those who are left behind, what does that kind of loss mean to this country?
Well, you know, we know, and this is something certainly Brady knows, is that the most important factor in a child's life, if they're going to overcome trauma, and a lot of these kids were dealing with trauma before the loss, is to have an adult in their life who loves them, right? And the nature of this loss is it's taking that person away. It's taking, for most of these kids, right, they're losing at least one of those people. And a lot of these were single parents, right? So that's a starting point, is it already deprives them of this thing that is so critical in their growth as a human being and overcoming whatever trauma they potentially already endured. And two, that sense that, well, what does this mean for me in my future? How does this devalue, you know, my own life, my own future? You know, and I think when we talk about sort of this sort of generational, that, you know, kids dealing with forms of loss, whether it's uncles, grandparents, cousins, there's such a ripple there, right, of what that person represented in the family. I mean, this case here, sort of seeing the ripple in Kayvon and Kaylee's life, beyond Kaylee and Kayvon, to the aunts, the grandparents, all these other people whose lives were blown up because of these shootings, it's just staggering. It's staggering. And that is never the way we think about it, right? And that's never really the way that the media writes about it. It's this, you know, four paragraphs. That's almost always how shootings in this country are reported, especially, frankly, in Black and brown communities. There is not that sort of effort to humanize and to go in and say, what is the ripple in this community? What is the ripple in this family? What does it look like day to day, that loss? We don't tend to treat those shootings in Chicago and Baltimore the same way that we treat, let's say, something that happens at a mall in the suburbs or at a school in the suburbs. And what I can say from having reported for years in all sorts of different communities is that the loss is enormous and lasting and profound regardless of where it happens.
When we had talked about Children Under Fire, you know, you had said that one of the reasons why you had initially focused on telling, you know, gun violence from the child's perspective is folks in the media or elsewhere, you know, couldn't say that it's a child's fault for being involved in a mass shooting. And I wonder, have you had the experience with this now reporting, though, that, you know, these are parents that have been lost or parents that have been taken, of folks saying, well, that's on them for being that they somehow were in a bad parent, that it's somehow the homicide victim's fault for, you know, and, you know, I'm doing air quotes, this is not a visual medium, so it's not helpful for listeners, but, you know, that you put yourself in a bad situation or you were doing something right. You shouldn't do. Have you seen that stigma spill over here as well? That, yes, it's sad for the kids, but all these, you know, their parents should have better done X, Y, or Z.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That I've gotten those emails from on this exact story, people saying that, well, you know, because both these parents had, you know, served time. But, you know, my perspective on that is why does that matter? You know, in a story that is about a child's loss or child's trauma, you know, Kaylee and Kayvon, it didn't matter to them. They didn't feel any less loved because their mother had served some time in jail on a drug charge. You know, their loss was not in any way diminished by her you know, her choice to go in an area where she was killed that was dangerous, right? I mean, that her daughter certainly resents that. She wishes they, you know, her daughter never felt safe in the area where her mother was killed. But, you know, people work really hard. A certain type of person in this country works really hard to dismiss anything related to gun violence as not mattering. They're looking for a reason to say, this is, you know, it has nothing to do with the gun. This isn't a gun problem. It's a people problem. It's a crime problem. It's a race problem. It's a, you know, they're looking for any sort of way to deflect blame off of either guns or our firearm regulations in this country. And, you know, that's a trope that I see all the time. And you know, what I tell people is that America is not uniquely evil. We do not have more evil people in this country than we do in other developed countries, right? The difference in our country and other countries is that we have 400 million plus guns and we have laws that are really bad at regulating those guns. That is the difference. You know, and I often am sort of having that discussion with people who are really committed to the idea of American exceptionalism as well, right? It's like something, you have to give up something here. But there just simply is no evidence that we're a uniquely evil people. It's just that people have considerably more access to, especially to handguns in this country than they do in other developed nations. And that is consistently why we're left in this situation. So, you know, I constantly deal with that. Well, here's the real reason, right? Here's the real reason that this happened. And it's not to diminish things like, you know, gang violence is a problem in this country. Drug trafficking is a problem in this country. Those are things that are problems, absolutely. But that's also problems in lots of other developed countries that do not have these rates of gun violence, not even close, right? There are gangs. There is drug trafficking in all these other countries. What's different here is that anybody can get a gun and they can get ammunition almost regardless of their age. And if they're, you know, willing, they can go take somebody's life with it.
It's interesting, you know, when you talk about people saying, here's the real problem, because one of the things that JJ and I have seen is whenever people talk about the real problem, they never talk about trauma and the role that that can play in perpetuating violence. And something that you talk about in your article is how the kids who are suffering the loss of a loved one to gun violence, they won't recover without help. And this is a quote. But in order to get the help, the country has to actually acknowledge that the children who lose their parents to gun violence are also victims of it. And we talked about this a little bit earlier as to why children who lose their parent to gun violence should be included in the definition of victim. But how would that then allow them to get the help that they would need to go on to live as healthy a life as they can?
You know, the thing that I talk about all the time is investment, right? And this goes back to that very first story I wrote that, you know, sort of led to the book in Taishan School. It was a formative moment for me in my thinking about how we respond to shootings and how we help kids. And it was, you know, Taishan's father was killed after a string of shootings all in his neighborhood. There've been six shootings all on Wheeler Road, just road in Southeast DC. And in the aftermath of that, they had this community meeting and they had asked the students in their school to draw pictures of what made them sad about their neighborhood. And this school only went up to, you know, second or third grade. So we're talking about kids who were 6, 7, 8 years old. And the pictures that they drew were of people being shot to death, vivid scenes of people being killed, funerals and grave sites and just incredibly vivid scenes of violence. And these were not drawn from television or from video games. These were things that these kids had actually witnessed. And, you know, this was a charter school that was in that community specifically to support kids who were dealing with trauma, dealing with poverty, generational trauma, right? And yet there was one psychiatrist for the entire school and none of the teachers had gone through any sort of trauma-informed training. They were doing the best they could, but it just realized to me, like, okay, this is a whole school full of kids who need support. They need somebody to talk to. They need a professional to talk to. And even in a school that is specifically there to help those kids, they're not really prepared to do it. So what we have to do societally, I think, is say, recognize the reality of the trauma and then say, we're going to make the financial investment that it requires to put kids or to put therapists in those schools to support those kids. It is so hard in this country to get children who are victims of gun violence in any way appropriate care. And what I've come to realize after doing this for years is it's not enough to say, just send them to a therapist. They need the right therapist. And you know, part of this last story I wrote gets into that. You know, the city of Baltimore had a woman who was specifically trained to treat these children, children who had lost parents to homicide. And she did special training and she really knew how to connect with them in a way that I have not seen other therapists able to do that. So it's not enough, the starting point is they need therapy. They need access to good mental health care. They need to be in classes with teachers that don't expel them when they flip over a chair because their cousin was killed over the weekend. And then beyond that, you have to train people, right? You need people who are actually qualified. And it's a high bar, but you know, we've spent in this country billions, hundreds of billions of dollars on all sorts of things that have nothing to do with improving anyone's life. The money's there, right? But to me, so much of it comes down to seeing those children in places like Baltimore, D.C., Chicago, and saying that their lives are as valuable as the lives of the children who go through the school shooting at the white suburban school. The way we respond to those two things is radically different in this country. So those shootings, the GoFundMes raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, the governor issues a statement saying how sad they are about what happened. And, you know, the therapy dogs come in and dozens of therapists volunteer their time. There is always, always, always a ton of support, which is great. That is exactly the way it should be. Right. So the argument is not that it shouldn't be that way. The argument is that it should be that way also when children who are dealing with chronic gun violence go through similar losses. But just because they're in a different community where societally has said, well, that's just the way it is for those kids, they don't have access to that same sort of support. And it's not going to get better until we decide that these kids' lives are as valuable as these other kids' lives.
Yeah. And I love that you point that out because I think sometimes the solutions that the, let me tell you the real problem crowd will come up with ignore the ways that gun violence stop people from being able, like they'll say, well, just stay in school, kids, get an education. And like, yes, we're going to tell children to deal with the same level of trauma that soldiers deal with at the age of 7 and to be able to have the foresight to be able to concentrate on, you know, learning about Joe and Jane going up the hill when they don't even know if they're going to be able to live. That's how we're going to solve this problem. So I appreciate you pointing that out.
That's such an important point. And I reference this one study all the time when the subject comes up is the study down in Chicago where they looked at children who had neighborhoods where someone had died in a homicide. And then they found that in those neighborhoods, the children who lived in those neighborhoods, that they did worse on their test scores the following week. Which means they didn't have to know the person, they didn't have to see it, they didn't have to hear the shooting. They just had to know someone in my neighborhood was shot to death last week, and it had such an effect, such a lingering effect, that they did worse in their test scores the following week. So then you take those kids, and then think about Kayvon, whose father's killed, whose mother's killed, and then he nearly gets shot. And I guarantee he was in school 2 days later. What is our expectation of him? Are we really going to ask him to say, you better do well. Like, it's on you, right? It's on you to work your way through this. Like, give me a break. You know, it's like, and you're absolutely right. That sort of crowd tends to avoid that reality. It's totally unfair. And it's just not based in any reality at all.
Well, and John, I don't want to, you know, it's unfair of me to say, to expect you to give me an answer on how to fix this, right? But do you have any suggestions for listeners who are concerned and want to do something?
You know, there are sort of two ways that I always talk about what do we do about our gun violence problem. And, you know, one is the front end. How do we prevent the act of gun violence from occurring to begin with? You know, the thing that I always say, the most obvious thing that anybody can do is lock up the guns that they have. And if they have friends who own guns, educate them on the importance of just locking up a firearm, right? We could save hundreds of children's lives, you know, thousands of lives every year if people just locked up the guns that they have, if they just kept them out of falling in the hands of children. And I say this all the time that, you know, for a lot of Americans, the only form of gun violence they really care about is a school shooting. That's the only thing that ever gets their attention. And if that is the only thing you care about, which is certainly not true of your listeners, but if they have friends and that's the only thing they care about, if we just locked up the guns that we have, if we just prevented children from obtaining firearms, well, more than half of the school shootings in this country would end overnight. That's the only change that we made. You know, Oxford, the shooting in Oxford, that would never have happened. 11 people wouldn't have been shot. 4 kids would be alive today. So if that's the only thing people care about, that's the one change, right, that we could make. It would have a profound difference. And I can go on and on about the other things we could do to prevent shootings, but I always see that as like the most obvious sort of bit of low-hanging fruit is and there's reams and reams of statistics that show, you know, having an unlocked firearm in a home, how much more likely that is to lead to suicide, to lead to an accidental shooting, to lead to somebody dying by a gun. And then, you know, on the other side, we know that we're not going to get that number to zero, the number of people who are dying in shootings every year. So, you know, what can we do, right? What can we do to support these kids? And to me, so much of it comes down to money. It just comes down to investment, is that people, if you show up to city council meetings, show up and get in the face of lawmakers to say, you know, what are you doing to support these kids? What sort of investment are you making? People have to decide that that is an issue that they're going to vote on, that they're actually going to fight for. And because it just is as simple as, does this school have the proper training? Do the teachers in the school have the proper training, which is something that costs money? Are there enough therapists in this school that have the proper training? It's dollars, right? It's money. And we have to decide that, you know, whatever thing we're spending money on, wherever those other dollars are going, that they would be better spent on this. But people have to speak up, show up to meetings, and actually make themselves heard. So those are kind of two clear things in my mind that sort of everyday people, everyday citizens in this country can do to make a real tangible difference.
That's a great point that you made about the school shootings. And, you know, even if that's the only thing that you care about, given the number of people who have guns in this country, there's a lot of power just in safely storing guns. Obviously a lot more than that to go, but I think that's definitely a point I just wanted to like reiterate, make sure people heard it.
Right. And I say this too, I always add this, is that this would do nothing to infringe on anybody's right to own a gun, right? So if you have a gun owning friend who is really resistant to any sort of regulations, I say this all the time, you could still go buy your 15 AR-15s. You could still do that. What this one element is asking you to do is to be responsible with the guns that you have, because we know you cannot educate a child out of making a bad choice with a gun. That is undeniable, right? Little children are curious. Teenagers are impulsive. Children simply cannot have access to firearms. But someone following this, someone actually applying this sort of thinking that I'm going to lock up my weapons, doesn't mean they can't still own those weapons. It just means you have to be responsible with the guns that they have. So, you know, hopefully people listening, who I'm sure are people who lock up their guns if they have them. If they have friends who don't, you know, steal these talking points and please go convince them, because literally during the course of this conversation that we're having, a child is going to find a loaded gun in a home. And it's just a matter of whether they fire it, kill themselves, kill somebody else, whether they survive being shot. It will happen, because it happens constantly in this country.
Well, and we want it to stop happening. So thank you, John, for all the work that you've done and that you continue to do. And of course, the link to not just your book, but to this article that we've been discussing today will be here in the description of this episode. So folks, go read it, please. And do as John says, get involved.
Yeah, I just want to sit for a minute with the information that John shared with us today, because over 40 kids a day losing a parent is such a huge number. And to know that in actuality, it's likely much higher than that is just mind-bogglingly sad.
Exactly. And then add to that number, right? Suicide loss. Add in non-biological parents. Add in other sorts of guardians. Add in non-minor children.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a minor, but losing a parent would be hard on anyone. And imagine an 18-year-old who is legally an adult, but very well may still depend on their parents for so much.
And as John said, I think that we just have to make a decision, right, as a country, that we're not going to tolerate this loss. and make a concerted effort to address this issue, just like we would any other public health crisis. Hey, want to share with the podcast? Listeners can now get in touch with us here at Red, Blue, and Brady via phone or text message. Simply call or text us at 480-744-3452 with your thoughts, questions, concerns, ideas, whatever. Kelly and I are standing by.
Thanks for listening. As always, Brady's life-saving work in Congress, the courts, and communities across the country is made possible thanks to you. For more information on Brady or how to get involved in the fight against gun violence, please like and subscribe to the podcast. Get in touch with us at bradyunited.org or on social at BradyBuzz. Be brave and remember, take action, not type.